course, you know, the stars are always out there. Humans have been looking up at the stars since the beginning, and they've inspired love songs like that one, and poems, and religions, and philosophies, and have asked us, you know, inspired a lot of questions as well. I mean, and the central one of the central questions of human existence is, of course, is, are we alone? We've been asking that question for a long time. We don't really have an answer, but we suspect there is probably life out there elsewhere. My next guest, Dr. Avi Loeb, has a distinguished career, a long resume of honors. He's a professor of science at Harvard University. He's the chairman of the astronomy department. He's involved with a number of very impressive projects trying to figure out human origins and our place in the universe and whether there's anyone else out there or not. But you probably hadn't heard his name until about 3 years later when a visitor came into our neighborhood. That visitor is named Oumuamua. It's been explained away as a piece of space rock. That was the general impression of the science community. But Dr. Loeb and some colleagues had another idea. They thought the evidence, what we have learned about this object, suggests that it was artificial, that somebody made it, that it came, it's the first interstellar object ever detected, and it came into our solar system and then returned on its way. And we suspect that, at least some people suspect, that the evidence shows that it was manufactured, that maybe it was sent here on purpose to get our attention. Dr. Loeb has written a new book about this. He's written some articles about it as well that have caused a big stir in scientific circles, generated a lot of arguments with his scientific colleagues, but he is sticking to his guns. And amazingly enough, he agreed to stay up late tonight and join us and talk about the book, the evidence, and Oumuamua. We'll be right back with Dr. Loeb. When I saw that there was a new book out by Dr. Avi Loeb, I'd asked my producer, Chris Boros, to reach out and see if there's any chance he would come on this program. And we are thrilled that he said yes. Dr. Loeb, I welcome to Coast. Thank you for staying up so late. It occurred to me maybe astronomers stay up late at night anyway, so that's why you said yes.
Thank you very much for having me. No, I'm actually a theoretical astrophysicist, so I don't look much to telescopes. I try to understand what the results that they obtain mean. And I actually, it's waking up early, not getting to bed late, because I usually jog at 5 a.m. every morning since the pandemic started. It's really fun. No people are around, and I'm in the company of ducks, birds, and rabbits, and it's really relaxing. So you are speaking with me just a couple of hours before I go to my morning job.
All right. Well, we appreciate it. I have to tell you, I finished the book today. It's terrific. It's just a wonderful read. It's very personal. It's a personal journey. And I think your personal story is every bit as compelling as the discussion about the space rock. You know, your career, you've always had this rigorous curiosity about the universe, and it's a long way from a family farm in a tiny village in Israel to Harvard and chairman of the department.
Well, it's a long way geographically, but for me, I haven't changed much. I'm still a kid on a farm wondering about some fundamental questions. And I see science as a way of life, not as an occupation of the elite or as a way to get a better status and elevate your image among your colleagues to get awards and honors. These issues are really secondary. It's all about us understanding nature, and I approach it without any calculations about how many likes I would get on Twitter or whether my colleagues agree with me. I just stick to the evidence as much as possible. And the only way to change my opinion on a matter would be to convince me that the evidence shows something else. And in the case of Oumuamua that we will discuss in a few minutes, my colleagues did not do that, and therefore I maintain my opinion. And my book details where my opinion comes from.
Well, it also tells about where you came from. I mean, you live on this family farm in a tiny village in Israel, and your family's growing pecans and grapefruit. Both sides of your family managed to dodge the Nazis. They got out of there. Your grandfather left Germany. Your mother left Bulgaria, managed to get away from the Nazis. And every step of the way, you acknowledge that if anything had been different, your life would have been different.
That's true, yes. Well, first of all, I grew up embedded in nature, and I much appreciate whatever nature gives us. You know, speaking about Oumuamua, about a year ago, there was a seminar on this object at Harvard, and a colleague of mine, at the end of the seminar, we left the room. A colleague of mine was telling me as we went down the corridor, he said, this object is so weird, I wish it never existed. And that basically summarizes the reaction of many of my colleagues. They prefer to do business as usual, not to disturb the comfort zone. And I view nature as a blessing. Whatever nature shows us through experimental data, we should respect. And I got this sense from growing up on a farm and, you know, appreciating nature more than what people say, because people very often have a biased view of what's happening around them, and they have wishful thinking, and that has to be put aside when you do science. And on the farm, I should say, I used to be interested mostly in philosophy. You know, I used to drive a tractor to the hills and read philosophy books, because they address the most fundamental questions. But then I had to serve in the military, and physics was the only intellectual work that I could pursue that is useful for the defense of the country. And I was good in physics. One thing led to another, and I ended up at Harvard. In a position that nobody else wanted, because people thought that it's impossible to get tenured at Harvard. And I got tenured and became department chair eventually, because I always had the plan B. I could always go back to the farm if things did not work out. I was quite relaxed about it. At the end of the day, you know, even though it was an arranged marriage, that astrophysics was not really my first passion, but I ended up doing it due to circumstances, by all these positions that were offered to me that I couldn't turn down. At the end, it looked like I'm married to my true love, because astrophysics does bring in philosophical questions that are quite fundamental, like how did the universe start, or are we alone? You know, these are questions, or how did life start, and things like that, and is there life elsewhere? You know, these are issues that are not only discussed in philosophy, but also in religions. If you open the first chapter of the Bible, the Old Testament, obviously it was a concern to those people that that wrote it.
Of course, yeah, philosophy leads you to science. Accidental of scientist or astronomer, I think, is what you had written in the book. And if not for your position, your accolades, your accomplishments, your stature as chairman of the department at Harvard, it would be harder for you to take this on. I mean, you're able to withstand some of the criticism, right? Because of who you are
Yeah, for sure. But two things. First, young people obviously are not do not have that privilege, because they have to worry about getting a job. And if you go against the mainstream, your chances are much smaller. So they're extremely careful. I tend to work with young people, and I can see their reactions to the pushback. But I should say that the one privilege about academia is that there is this concept of tenure that is given exactly for this purpose, so that it gives you the freedom of mind, so that you're not tied to the attempt to satisfy your colleagues. Now, this concept of tenure is unique to academia. It's a job security and allows you to, people give trust in your ability to do the right thing in the long term. And I take full advantage of that. Most of my colleagues do not. Most of my colleagues, when they get tenure, all they worry about is their image, how they are perceived by others, because they worry about getting awards, getting honors. But I follow the dictum of basketball coaches that say, keep your eyes on the ball, not on the audience. So I'm trying to ignore the audience, just look at the evidence, and draw conclusions from that.
Can you describe the level of pushback of criticism that you've received since coming out with the paper, and then doing interviews, and now the book? You write about it in the book. There's a lot of negative consequences for you having the courage to pursue this.
Right. I make the analogy also in the book with a statement that was made when I served in the military. It was said that sometimes a soldier needs to put his body on the barbed wire in order to let others go through. I see it as a service to the younger generation of tomorrow, that I want young scientists to be able to speak about this subject that is currently a taboo. And frankly, I mean, speaking as a kid from a farm, you know, frankly, I don't see why. It's quite ridiculous, in my opinion, because we now know from the Kepler satellite data that about half of the sun-like stars have a planet of the size of the Earth. This was a conclusion of a paper that appeared just a few months ago. Those planets of the size of the Earth are roughly the same distance as the Earth is from the Sun. So the Earth-Sun system is fairly typical. You know, not only that we are not at the center of the universe, but the things we see around us, the Earth and the Sun combination, is not unusual. It's quite typical. And what that means is that you throw the dice of biology, of making life, billions of times in the galaxy, and it would be completely arrogant to say, oh, what we have here, the outcome is unique and special. The much more conservative and mainstream, I would think, approach would be to say, okay, if you arrange for similar circumstances, you get similar outcomes. You know, what could be more conservative than that? It's completely common sense, you know. And if you were to adapt that, you would say, okay, it's likely that there is life out there, including technological life. We don't know if it's exactly at this time that civilization is alive, but even if it's dead, you know, other civilizations, even if they're dead, they could have produced artifacts that they left behind. That's the way we do archaeology on Earth. You know, we dig into the ground and find evidence for the Mayan civilization and others that used to exist but are not around anymore. So we can do the same thing in space. That would be the conservative view. That should be the mainstream. But instead, there is a taboo not to discuss this subject whatsoever. And I find that inappropriate and unhealthy. Now, based on my experience, you know, throughout the years, and here is another reason why I'm able to make my point, because I witnessed it multiple times when I promoted New Frontiers in the past, when nobody else was working on them. I noticed that after a while, when these frontiers became popular, then people jumped ship and then it became obvious to the younger people that entered those fields. They said, what? What do you mean? Obviously, this is a thriving field. It's completely part of the mainstream. So in retrospect, all this stubbornness and resistance that you feel early on, you know, it's a natural process for people to get used to a new direction. And in here, I think really this should have been done decades ago. In fact, in the book, I talk about Winston Churchill that wrote an essay about it in 1939, and just before the Second World War. And he became prime minister, so he couldn't really pursue his interest in searching for life around other stars. But and instead, you know, then humanity wasted resources and killed a huge number of people during the Second World War for nothing. If we were to allocate the same resources to search for life the way Churchill envisioned it, then we could have found something by now. And my point is, the pushback that I see on Twitter and people speaking behind my back, and by the way, most of it is behind my back because people are cautious to go against me given all my leadership positions. All of this pushback, I think, is unwarranted and inappropriate. I want to change the current situation such that it will become completely natural to work on this subject.
You write in the book, you know, if evidence of an ET civilization appeared sort of in our neck of the cosmic woods, would we even notice? And I guess with this object, we almost didn't. Is that right?
Right. So exactly. The point is the evidence could be subtle because, you know, if you go through a simple calculation of what signals you might get from a spaceship And I did that calculation many times. The signal is quite weak. You really need a huge amount of energy being transmitted for us to see it if it's not in the radio. Radio signals can be transmitted across the galaxy, and we've been searching a little bit for those. But if you're talking about the technological signatures, like industrial pollution of atmospheres of planets, or artifacts on the surfaces of planets, photovoltaic cells, or artificial lights, you know, like city lights, these are things that we should make an effort to detect. They are not booming signals, and you know, why should we expect the signals to be easy to detect? I mean, if you go through the numbers, it requires a little of an effort to find those. And I think once we reach a threshold, once we reach the sensitivity needed, we might find the galaxy to be humming with such things. And we just need to search. Now, obviously, if the community says there is a taboo, let's not discuss it, and then people are ridiculed when they mention this possibility to explain anomalies like Oumuamua, obviously then you create a culture where young people, talented people, never go in this direction, and no resources are allocated. And then it's just like stepping on grass and saying, look, the grass doesn't grow. Obviously, we don't find anything because the community is acidic to this subject. Now, we can talk about why the community behaves this way. And there are a number of reasons. You know, one obvious reason is that there is this literature of science fiction and reports that are not substantiated as much as scientists would like them to be on unidentified flying objects. Okay, so, but my point is simple. Consider COVID-19, for example. Imagine that there was a literature of fiction on COVID-19 that made no sense. Imagine that people were making statements about COVID-19 that are ridiculous. Would that prevent scientists from developing a vaccine? Obviously not. I mean, the science can say, forget about all the nonsense that is being said by others. We can follow the standard scientific procedure and address this issue, okay? So issues that are discussed by others in a way that is non-scientific can be explored by science. And we have the technology and telescopes and everything to follow this question of the search for technological signatures. And I can give you one example that would illustrate the point. Astronomers every decade are deciding about their next priorities for the next decade. And the astronomy community in the U.S. is currently going through this process. And there are some proposals on the table for future observatories that will cost billions of dollars. And they would search for oxygen in the atmospheres of planets around other stars. So now the problem with oxygen is...
I tell you what, Dr. Loeb, I have to take a break. We're talking with Dr. Avi Loeb. We're talking with Dr. Avi Loeb, a Harvard astronomer, chairman of the astronomy department, about his new book, Extraterrestrial, The First Sign of Intelligent Life Beyond Earth. The object in question is Oumuamua. It's some scientists want to explain it away as just a piece of space rock, but Dr. Loeb and some of his colleagues took a closer look, examined the evidence, the data that they had, and they came to a much different conclusion that this thing was a spacecraft or could be a spacecraft sent here on purpose, perhaps to get our attention. What is the evidence? What is this object? We'll get into that in our next segment here on Coast to Coast AM. Professor Loeb, I want to ask you about the object itself, Oumuamua. It is significant in that it's the first interstellar object ever ever detected here. And but you could you describe sort of the parameters, how big it is, what we know about it, what you can confirm, and what evidence led you to believe that it might be something else?
Right. So it was discovered back in October 2017 by a telescope on Mount Haleakala in Hawaii called the Pan-STARRS. And it was given the name Oumuamua because it's the very first object that came from outside the solar system that we noticed in the vicinity of the Earth. And Oumuamua means a scout or a messenger from far away in the Hawaiian language. At first, astronomers thought it must be just like the objects we have seen already, within the solar system, the asteroids or the comets. Comets are just icy rocks that have ice on their surface, and when they get close to the sun, the ice evaporates and you get this beautiful cometary tail behind them. But the asteroids are just rocks, and they don't have that cometary tail. So at first the thought was they must be comets, because comets are coming to us usually from the outer part of the solar system and are loosely bound to the sun. And so if there is a passing star, it can really easily rip off these objects from the solar system, and the same may happen around other stars. So you would assume that the objects that become unbound as a result of passing stars are those that are sort of just like the comets that we see from the outer solar system. And the only problem was that there was no cometary tail. Not only no cometary tail visible in images of this object, but also the Spitzer Space Telescope looked very deeply around the object and couldn't detect any trace of carbon-based molecules, dust around it, meaning that it doesn't look like a comet. So then people said, okay, well, it could be just a rock. And the problem with that is, first of all, the brightness of the object changed by a factor of 10 as it goes tumbling every 8 hours. And the brightness stems from the reflected sunlight. So that means that the area of the object on the sky that was reflecting sunlight was changing by a factor of 10 as it was spinning. And that means that the object has an extreme geometry. And even if you consider a razor-thin piece of paper and let it tumble in the wind, it wouldn't change by more than a factor of 10 typically, because it's very unlikely to be exactly edge-on. But at any event, the best fit to the light curve of this object was that of a flat object, pancake-shaped, not cigar-shaped, the way that it was depicted in some cartoons. So we know that the object was at the 90% confidence flat, pancake shape, and we know that also it didn't have any cometary tail, but then it was found to deviate from an orbit expected by just by the force of gravity of the sun. And usually for comets, that's as a result of the rocket effect, when the evaporation of the comet causes a push. As the gases flow one way, they push the object in the opposite direction. And that's the way that the jet plane flies. But there was no cometary tail. So the question is, what gives it the extra push? And the only thing I could think of is reflected sunlight. For that to be effective, the object needs to be extremely thin, sort of like a sail on a boat, which reflects the wind. It's the reflection of sunlight. And you don't get such objects in nature. We do produce them as light sails. And it could be also, you know, a layer of material that is thin enough that just get, you know, gets pushed by the sun, reflecting sunlight. There is an interesting anecdote that in September 2020, just a few months ago, there was another object found that shows similar characteristics. It was pushed by sunlight and didn't have any cometary tail. Turns out that this was a rocket booster from a 1966 launch of a lunar lander. And at first, astronomers didn't know that it's a rocket booster, so they gave it an astronomical name, 2020 SO. But I think this example illustrates we can tell when an object is being pushed by sunlight and doesn't have a cometary tail. We can tell that it's artificial because in this case, it was made by us. But in the case of Oumuamua, it couldn't have been made by us. We know what we were doing in 2017, and it was moving faster than any rocket that we can launch, and it came from outside the solar system. So the question is, who produced it and why? That is the argument that was made in my scientific paper with my postdoc Shmuel Bialy back in 2018. But there are many other anomalies of Oumuamua that are discussed in my book. And it's just a peculiar object.
I mean, it would be significant just if it didn't have all these other peculiar characteristics, because it came from outside the solar system and that we almost missed it. It was on its way out, back out again, when it was detected and confirmed. And I guess there are no real photographs of it or clear photos that...
No, because the size is a few hundred feet and roughly the size of a football field. And at the distance, which is roughly the Earth-Sun separation, at that distance, our telescopes cannot resolve it. It's too small. So it looks like a point source of light, but all you can monitor is the amount of light that you get as it tumbles around. And, of course, we detected it when it was moving away from us, just like noticing that one of the guests that you had for dinner looks a little weird, but you notice it only by the time the guest goes outside the main door into the dark street. And so we discovered it only when it was receding from us. It was too late to chase it. But if we were to discover it in July 2017, at that time it was approaching us. I was actually visiting that observatory in Maui, Hawaii. I gave a talk there, and we were on vacation with my family in Maui. In July 2017, at that time, nobody knew about it. But I say if we were to spot it back then, we could have sent a CubeSat with a camera that would pass close to it as it was approaching us, and then take a close-up photo of it, and that would clarify its nature. So all we need is better evidence for the next object that shows around in our backyard.
And there was one. A second one is discovered later, right? A couple months later?
Yes, that is called the Borisov. It was discovered by an amateur astronomer, Gennady Borisov, and it looked just like a comet, very typical of the comets that we see, with some subtleties, but not significant. So then people approached me and said, look, this second one appears like a comet of natural origin. Doesn't that convince you that Oumuamua was also natural? To which I said, you know, when I met my wife on the first date, I thought that she's special and unique. The fact that I met a lot of women afterwards didn't change my opinion.
You know, the likeness that we've all seen, this cigar-shaped craggy rock, it almost seems to be purposely to make it seem like it's a rock. The reality in your book, you write that a colleague of yours, another scientist, figured out a 91% probability that this is disc-shaped, pancake or disc-shaped. Now, that's pretty provocative when you think about it.
Well, you know, we follow what the data is telling us. It's not a matter of being provocative. There is also the statement of extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, which I don't like, because the word extraordinary really depends on, it's very subjective, depends on who looks at the data. And we don't want to assign different thresholds for believing something depending on how unusual the community thinks the data is. Because if you go back to Galileo Galilei days, obviously philosophers thought that it's extraordinary to claim that the Earth moves around the sun. And so they put him in house arrest and didn't look through his telescope. And all that did was maintain their ignorance. It didn't change the fact that the Earth moves around the sun. So saying extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence is just inappropriate. I mean, we should just follow the evidence wherever it leads us.
Exactly, because if you have evidence for something, then it's not really an extraordinary claim.
No, it's not. And people, make this point about the requirement for extraordinary evidence so that they will not need to attend to the puzzling evidence. They prefer to be in their comfort zone. My point is you can stay in your comfort zone. You know, animals do it all the time. They just focus on eating and multiplying. You know, that's fine. You can live your life like that and ignore all the evidence around you. I have no problem with that. But don't, you know, forbid others from discussing a possible explanation to these anomalies, because that's the way science makes progress. You know, it's a learning experience. We are revising our notion about reality based on the evidence. And we can't say that a subject is a taboo, you know, in science. You can't do that. All that does is maintain our ignorance. And here in particular, you know, because the public is quite excited and interested in this question, and I find it completely inappropriate for the scientific community to shy away from it, given that we have the technology to address it. And the public funds science, and there is no reason for the scientific community to just argue this is a taboo. You know, we shouldn't and bully and ridicule anyone that works on a possible interpretation of an anomaly. You know, if there was no evidence for an anomaly, I would never speak about this subject. And the only reason that the two of us are speaking is because, you know, people don't do what the common sense requires them to do, to look at the data and try to explain it. There were a few astronomers that tried to do that and tried to explain it from a natural origin, Oumuamua, and they came up with scenarios that do not make much sense in my mind, like, for example, that it might be a dust bunny, you know, a collection of dust particles the size of a football field, a cloud in the sky that is very porous, you know, 100 times less dense than air. And that would be pushed also by sunlight, according to their calculation. And the only problem is I don't think it will survive. We've never seen something like that. And if you imagine a big cloud of dust that is the 100 times less dense than air, you know, floating through space, I find it hard to believe that it would survive. And another suggestion was that it's a hydrogen iceberg, a frozen hydrogen, so that when it evaporates, you can't see the vapor because it's transparent. Hydrogen is transparent. The problem with that is that, again, it wouldn't survive the journey because we showed that hydrogen evaporates very easily, and starlight that is absorbed by this iceberg would basically evaporate it in a very short time. So I find the alternatives that people propose less likely. There was another suggestion that it may be a fragment from a bigger object that's destroyed by a star. But again, the chance of something passing close to a star so that it's destroyed, and also the fragments would not be pancake-shaped. They would be elongated. So all of these suggestions illustrate that anyone that thought about this problem said, it must be something that we've never seen before. Okay, an object. And I say, if it's something we've never seen before, why not put on the table also the possibility of an artificial origin? I mean, again, common sense from a kid that grew up on a farm, I don't see why people have a problem dealing with that.
So you figured out in your book, Extraterrestrial, The First Sign of Intelligent Life Beyond Earth, you figure out that it came from Vega, from the direction of Vega. Would it have been sent on purpose, and might it have been sent to get our attention? I know we're speculating here, but what's your thoughts?
Well, it's not. It's definitely not coming from Vega, because this object is actually at rest in the public parking lot of the galaxy nearby. There is a frame of reference called the local standard of rest, which you get to when you average the motion of all the stars in the neighborhood of the sun. That's called the local standard of rest. And this object was at rest in that frame. Only one in 500 stars is so much at rest in that frame. So it's just like finding a car parked in a public parking lot. You can't tell where it came from, which house it came from. And that's another peculiar fact about this object, that it's not obvious which star to associate it with. And by the way, just as a background, the Oort cloud of the solar system extends halfway to the nearest star. So if the nearest star has an Oort cloud as well, these Oort clouds are very densely packed. You know, they're touching each other as stars move by. And so if you imagine one of the rocks in the outer Oort cloud being ripped apart from another star, if you see it coming in some direction, you will never be able to tell which star it's coming from, because, you know, in any direction you take, there is a huge number of stars along that path. And so it's completely hopeless to associate with a star. But the properties of the object are the more interesting thing. If we had a photograph and we could tell, look, it doesn't look like a rock.
Well, if, you know, we have, our civilization has sent out extra solar objects. We've sent out 5 craft that have gone beyond our solar system or are heading that direction. I think one of them has some Chuck Berry music on it as a calling card. So I could assume if there's civilizations out there, they might do the same thing.
Right. Well, it's presumptuous of us to expect our art to be appealing to extraterrestrials. And I think we are middle of the road kind of civilization. We are not really the smartest kid on the block or sharpest cookie in the jar. We are really sort of typical outcomes. Because what's the chance that the soup of chemicals that existed on Earth ended up making the very best cake that you can imagine? You know, very small. And, you know, you open the morning newspaper, you see how many foolish things humans do all the time. The mere fact that we waste most of our time and energy on fighting each other, on destructive activities, you know, that shows you that we are not intelligent, because the path forward is actually cooperation and working together. If we were to invest all the resources that we now invest in spying on each other, fighting each other, killing each other, if we were to invest that in a positive direction, like working together, we would be in a completely different place right now. So to me, we are intelligent, but, you know, there is a lot of room for improvement, I would say. Let's hope that we can learn a lesson from the sky. You know, we will find things that are more intelligent than we are.
We're talking with Avi Loeb about extraterrestrial, the first sign of intelligent life beyond Earth, Oumuamua. Sorry about that. Oumuamua is the name of the object, and another one was discovered. We're going to get into some of the big questions about how long it might have been out there and, what kind of message somebody's trying to send here. We'll be right back. We go into the break with one of Phil Spector's big songs, the Ronettes, Be My Baby. And Phil Spector died this weekend while serving a prison term for murder.